I think punk needs more cor anglais.
All things do.
You know what really makes us mad? Is wasting money on CDs with only one or two good songs.
Yeah. Tell them about punk.
What's up, posers? Welcome to Punk Lotto Pod, the game where no one wins. I'm your co-host, Justin Hensley.
I am your other co-host, Dylan Hensley.
And this is the show where using a number generator and the Rate Your Music Punk charts, we choose one album and one EP at random to discuss. Today, joining us, we have some special guests on. After 2 weeks of no guests, we are joined by fellow punk rock podcasters. Why don't you introduce yourself and tell us what your show is?
My name is Steve McGowan.
And I'm Adrian Madoc.
And our podcast is Single and Steady.
Yes, and we cover punk, DIY, new wave, and things influenced by those movements.
We approached the singles as through the prism of our band. We had a band in the 80s called The Beef People in Greenville, South Carolina. And we talk about singles that had an influence on us, on our songwriting. Or there was a period of time where we booked bands.
And we covered an awful lot of those songs. Important punk singles.
So a lot of the singles we'll talk about will be from bands that we either played with, we booked, we covered their songs, or they had a big influence on us. And we kind of try to bring in the personal on that, wouldn't you say?
Yes.
Yeah.
So we do the podcast. We also have a reissue label of our old stuff. The label is called Zub Records. This is all can be found at the zubrecords.com website, zubrecords.com. And you can listen to the podcast there. And we're available on all the normal streaming sites. Correct?
Yes, correct.
Dylan's actually the one who found your show and brought y'all to my attention. Do you remember how you found him?
I don't remember how I came across it. I might have just been kind of Googling punk podcasts, just looking for people doing something a little similar to our show. Because right. We've noticed a lot of punk podcasts are maybe more like radio shows where they just play songs, which is which is cool. But I was curious to see if there were people who were maybe talking about records similar to us, and I noticed y'all were based in North Carolina, South Carolina as well, or at least have that connection, and started kind of around the same time, have similar number of episodes. So I thought that was really interesting, and sent it to Justin, and it's like, hey,
something in the water.
These people are doing the same thing as us, just a little bit different, you know?
Right, the same. Really, complementary. You take on the big chunks, and we take the little chunks.
Yeah, which I also wanted to say, you have such a perfect name for your show. That is just the perfect choice.
Oh, and of course, poor Pete Shelley passed away after we recorded our first batch, and it had our logo and our name. Huge Buzzcocks fans, played a lot of Buzzcocks covers. Buzzcocks. So, it was just heartbreaking. So it ended up being a retroactive tribute.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just recently, y'all covered Sex Pistols' Anarchy in the UK and Clash's London Calling, which we did the Clash's Give Them Enough Rope a couple weeks ago, probably a couple months ago at this point. And you've covered other bands that we've talked about, like The Damned and The Ramones. And so it's like, you guys seem focused on like 70s and 80s primarily.
Yeah, because we're old.
Yeah.
Hopefully you are. And we, the way we do our show is we just try and like go from the beginning of punk to present day. So we've done plenty of 70s and 80s too. So there's a lot of overlap there. So if you listen to our show and you haven't listened to Singles Going Steady, give the show a listen because they cover a lot of the same ground we do. So cool. Well, we will get started, and this will be okay. So for this episode, we got the year 1976.
Generation and I can
And every week, whenever we pick our year, we like to go through the Rate Your Music charts for that year to discuss. And we have previously discussed 1976 two other times. We're trying to knock this year out.
once we've covered everything. I felt the same way during it.
Yeah, once everything is covered, then we won't have to talk about 76 again. So we will take a look at the chart real quick. It's not a huge chart. There's only 7 albums listed here. If you expand it to include everything that came out under the punk umbrella in 76, you get a little bit more, primarily more singles. So our number one we'll skip for the moment because we will be talking about that. But number 2 and number 3 are albums we've talked about in the past. The Ramones self-titled and Patti Smith's Radio Ethiopia. Two excellent, excellent records. The Ramones, you know, arguably kicked off this whole thing, punk rock thing, despite the proto-punk tagging and all that. But
I mean, they were the fuse that lit the bomb, I think.
Yeah, most definitely. And Patti Smith was right there along with them as far as, playing CBGBs and other New York venues and, helped kind of pave the,
art punk thing.
Yeah, definitely.
And then kind of an early crossover into the mainstream a little bit, too.
I think she kind of
carried a lot of that attitude.
Sadly, my first exposure to Patti Smith was through SNL, the parody that Gilda Radner did, Candy Slice.
right.
So you're right. I mean, it absolutely was in sort of the mainstream discussion.
But you have to admit that Radio Ethiopia is her strongest record. Kind of the band is still kind of learning how to play. They would get,
Yeah, we were definitely, when we talked about that one, I think we came to the same conclusion that, like, as far as at least the first couple records that she put out, like the first record, Horses, was the one that I preferred the most out of the earliest stuff. But
this one was a little bit of a step back, and then she moved forward after that for sure.
Yeah,
I don't think you can underestimate the Ramones though. I mean, all the bands were totally affected by it. And
the Ramones, when they played the gigs in England. After that first album, Steven said they were they lit that fuse that set off the bomb, but the bomb really was their appearance. Mm-hmm. That they were their own bomb. Mm-hmm. I mean, the explosion that they caused in the punk scene, it essentially helped spur, create, promote punk throughout England.
Yeah, I mean, there really was nothing like the Ramones, and then they just sort of like appeared, And all these other bands were like, we can do that or we could do that better, So I think that record coming out in 76 sets the table for 77, where all the juicy stuff starts to happen.
when we created our range of years at the beginning of the show, we were always like, well, 77 is the year punk blew up. But then we were like, well, that excludes the Ramones' first record if we do that.
Yeah.
Right.
So we purposely made a point to include 76 and say that it was the year of the first Ramones record. I mean, at some point we'll eventually run out of these albums to talk about, but that's fine. But you're right. They were definitely more the fuse than the Pistols were the bomb. That's like the perfect analogy for what exactly happened. And then I guess you could call like the Stooges and MC5 maybe the gunpowder.
Yeah.
True.
Or the casing.
the blueprint.
Yeah.
Because the whole manufacturing process of punk detailed all the way back to rockabilly of the 50s. Yeah.
It's the punk project management timeline.
Yes.
Looking at the rest of this list here, there's a record on here. It's number 4 on here. It's Debris and it's Static Disposal. Are either of you familiar with this record?
Not particularly, no.
Oh, it's my favorite record ever.
Well, I'm glad we have you on.
Just kidding.
I have no idea about Debris. I was wondering if it was good. You start with D, and I was like, how did DeBarge get on the list? But
yeah,
it's funny. I've seen their name on, when we've done this list before, I've seen their name a few times, and I don't understand who they are. I guess I should listen to them one day, but it's
you definitely stumped the band here.
Oh, yeah.
Their Debris were, okay. It says they formed in 1975 in Chickasha, Oklahoma.
Oh yeah.
Oh yeah, the cradle of punk. Mm-hmm.
So it's just they've got a Vibraheart, a cornet. Strange.
Very it's weird. The classic lineup. The classic lineup.
I think punk needs more cor anglais.
All things do.
We have a recent addition to this chart, which doesn't really make sense when you think about it. But one of the things about Rate Your Music that's neat and it's also very frustrating is that it's very user-based. Right. So the genre tags tend to get applied by the users. And when we started doing the show, the Runaways record on here was not on the list at all.
Mm.
Which is strange because I would very happily have been talking about the Runaways, a year ago. Because I guess technically they're not really a punk band, but Joan Jett isn't either, and she is very closely tied as far as maybe it's the attitude and the aesthetic of punk rock.
There's a lot of DIY there. We saw
we did a podcast on Cherry Bomb.
And back with Joan Jett, there's a great documentary talking about really how she did not make headway with major labels and Black Heart Records. That's all like their own DIY shop within.
Have you guys seen that documentary, Bad Reputation?
No. I really want to watch it. Yeah. I just haven't.
It's great. It's really well done.
I think Joan was rejected by like 22 labels before they decided to form their own label, and they sold, hundreds of thousands of records. So she's totally DIY. And, I think we pretty much decided that the Runaways were definitely proto-punk, I mean, they had the punk attitude. They wanted to kind of be a little bit more metal, but they really didn't have the chops at the time.
Mm-hmm.
But they were just badasses because, everybody was like, the whole sexist thing, you're girls, you can't have a band, you don't know what you're doing. And they were just like, screw you guys to everybody, They did what they wanted to do, and it doesn't get any more punk than that,
Yeah. I mean, I fully believe they should be more closely associated with the punk scene. Yeah. I don't know if people today quite get how big of a deal they were, especially when you look at like these early albums. Like we've got Patti Smith and the Runaways. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to think of we had Nico playing with Velvet Underground.
Right.
All these really strong women musicians in the scene and help form it, and Tina and Talking Heads, and
Tina Weymouth doesn't get enough credit as a phenomenal bass player,
right?
And when you think about Velvet, some people think about Nico, but Tucker on drums. The woman as an instrumentalist,
wouldn't be a Jesus and Mary Chain without Mo Tucker. They took that whole Tom Tom thing straight from her,
And it's something that I feel like it's kind of missing in the UK punk scene. Like, I mean, we have X-Ray Specs, and you have Susie and the Banshees and the Slits, but it was just so dominated by the Pistols and the Buzzcocks and the Damned and all these guys. I feel like the US early proto stuff. Like the women were just as big a deal in the CBGB scene, New York punk scene, and then I guess the last true album on here is this Eddie and the Hot Rods Teenage Depression. I listened to a little bit of it.
A good record.
Yeah, I was surprised. I mean, it's definitely the pub rock thing.
Yeah, it's interesting. Yeah, I just read No Sleep Till Canvey Island, which is Will Birch's book on pub rock. And that really the DIY roots that are there and the screw you, we'll do what we want. I mean, that's so much a part of pub rock that bridge is not as transparent or as obvious to especially to Americans.
Because the pub rock really was a reaction to the Emerson, Lake and Palmers.
Yeah.
And that you can't, we can just get two guitars, a bass and drum and go down the pub and knock out some songs, So the attitude is definitely more DIY.
Yeah. And it's more like we can DIY.
Right. Right.
You know, it's the can-do attitude. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that really is a fair forebear of punk.
And pretty much you were telling me the other night, Adrian, that everything that happened on Stiff really, you know, was from the punk rock.
Or from pub rock.
Pub rock. All those, that's basically how Stiff Records
built itself. That's essentially owes its origin to pub rock and, you know, circling back to Eddie and the Hot Rods.
Yeah. Yeah. And Barry Masters just died the other week, which is a shame. Yeah.
Yeah, and so much of that UK punk scene came out of that pub rock scene, or those bands that helped blow it up were pub rock bands beforehand. So
right.
I mean, if you listen to Dr. Feelgood now, I mean, it's kind of hard to, you know, it's definitely blues based, but it's got a punk drive to it. You know, it's nasty and it's fast and it's slashing and, you know,
heartfelt.
Yeah,
and snarly.
Well, great. Then I think we can jump into our album if everyone's ready.
Right.
And all right, for this week, we got number one on the Rate Your Music chart. It is The Modern Lovers and their self-titled album, quote unquote, The Modern Lovers.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6.
I'm going to run through some quick basics real quick. The Modern Lovers were a retroactively assigned proto-punk band from Natick, Massachusetts, which is a suburb of
Natick.
Boston. Natick.
Mm-hmm. He's a Massachusetts.
I lived up there.
Yeah, I listened to your episode that you did on Jonathan Richman's Roadrunner, which we'll talk about in a little bit. And yeah, I wanted to make sure, and I messed up the name of the town, but there we go. They formed in 1970 and broke up
in Wicked hard to pronounce.
It's wicked pissa. Yeah, it's a pissa.
The Modern Lovers formed in 1970, broke up in 1974. So this is a posthumous release, I guess. And it's the debut album. Wasn't released until August of 76 on Berserkly Records, which also released... The most notable releases I saw on there were the Greg Kinn Band. And the personnel on this record is Jonathan Richman on guitar and vocals, Ernie Brooks on bass, David Robinson on drums, and Jerry Harrison on piano and organ. David Robinson would later go on to be in the Cars, and Jerry Harrison would join the Talking Heads, so I think they did pretty well for themselves.
And don't forget Ernie Brooks. He was the leader of a Boston band called the Real Kids, who were they were quite a thing back in Boston in the day.
Jonathan Richman would start performing as Jonathan Richman and the Modern Lovers, and David Robinson would play in that briefly, but that version of the Modern Lovers is a little different. I'd almost call it like a folk group more than anything, and that direction that Jonathan Richman wanted to go in is primarily the reason why the band broke up. Last big thing I'll hit before we get into the opinions on this record. Some of these tracks were produced by John Cale from the Velvet Underground for Warner Brothers Records. And a couple of the tracks were produced by Alan Mason for A&M Records. So They recorded them between 71 and 72 as demos for a full length later, which never materialized. And it's interesting. I didn't research too deep into it. So I assume there was like almost a battle between who was going to sign them, if it was Warner Brothers or A&M. But I wonder what that would have looked like, that alternate reality where they never broke up and they were on Warner Brothers.
Yeah, sadly, I think there would be cutout bins full of mishandled major label
Modern Lovers Records.
Records.
Yeah.
I wonder if they would have, if they had signed to a major label so early, if they would be classified as a proto-punk band so much as they are now. Because I don't know. I wonder how those records would have ended up sounding.
Oh yeah, yeah. They would have mic'd, you know, the desk.
There'd have been sweetening going on. Oh yeah. As they yeah. Say.
All right.
Get the Jordanaires in there to back him up.
Yeah.
I'd like to hear that.
Yeah.
That would actually be pretty good.
The old world may be dead, our parents can't understand, but I still have parents, and I still love the old world. Oh, I had a New York girlfriend, and she couldn't understand how I could still have parents, and still love the old world. So I told her, I wanna keep my place in the old world, and keep my place in the arcane, cause I still have parents, and I still love the old world. Alright. I say old world, I say old world, I say.
So, all that being said, since you two are the guests today, what did you think of this record?
Oh, we've always been big fans of this record, and let's start with a little bit of the history, and we can add a little bit more to it.
Okay.
We've read a book by Ryan H. Walsh called Astral Weeks,
right.
It's technically about a short period in Van Morrison's life where he lived in Boston before he did the album Astral Weeks. But it's really just kind of a long story about Boston. And in the story, they talk a lot about Jonathan Richman and the Velvet Underground. And Jonathan was a huge Velvets fan.
Which you can hear.
Obviously, yeah. We'll get into. But he used to drive them around. They would play. The Velvets played at the Boston Tea Party venue. Like 42 times.
It was really their home base, right? Because, you know, there was not a place in New York mm-hmm. City that was Velvets friendly.
They only played in New York 14 times.
Yeah.
And, which is so funny because they're so tied to that.
Right, right. And they really weren't, you know. And Jonathan would drive them around and would hang out with them and
go to New rehearsals. Yorkers. They didn't know how to drive. They didn't have a car.
Right, exactly. And so he was completely, you know, affected by this suburban kid from Natick, which is out on, you know, Route 128 by the power lines, by Shopper's World. It's in the ring outside of Boston, and I used to live in that area. So his initial stuff had a very, very Velvets.
Right, because, mm-hmm. I mean, they were not a remote influence. They were...
Direct.
Direct. I mean, he was their driver.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. He was friends with them, and... He opened for them once or twice when somebody didn't show up. And
well, I mean, and John Cale recorded the demos with them.
Which is why, you know, you were talking about what would it have sounded like on a major label. Well, they wouldn't have had John Cale produce it, I'm sure.
Right. You know,
and of course, you know, you listen to our Roadrunner podcast. The first thing we do is as musicians, it's Roadrunner is Sister Ray by the Velvets. You know, it's a simpler version of it. It's a two chord song.
When when you played that, it kind of blew my mind, like how similar it was.
Yeah, right. So I mean, he's not
hiding his influences.
Influences, yeah, and so that's one of the real things you got to. The original version of the Modern Lovers, he's basically. He was influenced by other things too, but the Velvets is definitely. I think the line they always say is the Modern Lovers record is the bridge between the Velvet Underground and the Sex Pistols. You know, and we were talking about it because we've covered Jonathan Richman's song.
Yeah, we play Abominable Snowman.
We have a version of Abominable Snowman that we do. And why were all these bands so interested in Jonathan Richman's music? One of the things is it's simple.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You know, speaking as a punk, we were punk musicians. We are punk musicians. When you're first learning, you're teaching yourself how to play the guitar. You can only play a couple of chords.
Yeah.
You know, you can play Roadrunner because it's only two chords. You know, you can play, Time Has Come Today by the Chambers Brothers. It's only four chords, you know. These are the songs you seek out, and you're like, oh, I can do this, you know. And that's what all those British bands were doing, because all those British bands played Roadrunner. Clash did, the Pistols, you know, that was a just on everybody's playlist.
And I think the reason this album is so influential is one, it's easy to pick up and play. Mm-hmm. It's sincere.
Sincere.
It's there's no BS here.
Right.
It's, Jonathan just absolutely bears his soul.
Yes.
You know, he could be snarky and, you know, I'm thinking about Pablo Picasso.
Yeah.
You know, but, he sings about longing and needing love. And,
right.
And, in such a direct unvarnished way, and I think that authenticity is the thing that really spoke to the early punk bands. One, I can play it. I can play a faster, louder version of some of these songs, I can make my own Son of Sister Ray punk version of this Jonathan song, and throw new lyrics on it that mean something to me. But you know, the whole album is. I think it's authentic, it's honest, it's straightforward.
His heart is on both of his sleeves.
Right.
Yeah.
I've seen people describe Jonathan as almost childlike, which I understand maybe what they're saying there, but I mean, the themes are deeper than that.
Oh, yes. Yeah, yeah.
He's singing about, you know, real heartbreak and love and singing about, like, you know, the mundane, singing about kind of everyday life stuff in a way that is more poetic than childlike. But so there's, I don't know, I guess I would say it's more earnest, but than childlike.
Yeah, earnest is the word. Yeah, absolutely.
Well, she was sensitive. She understood me. She understood the European things from 1943. But she does all these things that I can't stand. I get jealous. She stays with another man. She cried. I'm sad, but I won't. Oh, she cried. I'm hurt. You're right. Oh, well, she. These things that I thought she'd self-destroy, necessary to our self-enjoy. I self-develop, necessary to our self-help. She cries, I'm sad, but I won't. That's right. She cries, I'm hurt. All right.
It's almost like having hyper-realism in visual art. I mean, because he is talking about like you say, the mundane, you know, driving around in Massachusetts.
Right.
You know, and the things that you see, these mm-hmm. everyday items. But, I mean, he is the poetry in the mundane, the right. poetry in the everyday.
The way he looks at the world.
Yes. Mm-hmm. I mean, and maybe that's where they're getting the childlike, mm-hmm. because he looks on it with wonderment and he celebrates it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. He sees things other people don't see. We were talking last night specifically about the song Astral Plane.
Mm-hmm.
And Jonathan's lyric is about removing the physical from a relationship. I want to love you on the astral plane.
Mm-hmm.
And we were talking about how that mimics the transcendentalists, you know, like Emerson and Thoreau and, you know, the people that the poets that were from that area in Massachusetts. And it's kind of a heavy concept, you know, love without the physical, real on a higher level, on an astral plane. Mm-hmm. And, you know, this is all in a little proto-punk song, you know. It's yeah. pretty, he unlocked a whole new kind of love song, you know, how often do you hear people talking about themes like that, right, you know, right. It's like, wow, you know, and,
you know, and it's also very, you know, it's steeped in Massachusetts, the experience of being in that greater yes. Boston area, mm-hmm. where those figures mm-hmm. are essentially still walking right, among right. folks.
In the footsteps of them, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, I'd get the impression that you two very much love this record. Is that?
Oh, yeah.
That's accurate. Dylan, I kind of have an idea of what you feel about this record. Well, hey, I'm leading a little bit, Dylan. what was your thoughts on this record?
I like this record. It's not a record that I have dipped my toes into very often. I have heard it a few times, and I've heard a good bit of Jonathan Richman's later music, which my mileage doesn't go quite as far with him, too far past Modern Lovers. But I do love the way the band sounds on this record. Mm-hmm. I really like how stripped down and simple mm-hmm. it is. I was thinking, it's funny, like, you could easily imagine this record. I mean, for one, you can imagine these songs being played almost any number of ways because they're so simple. I mean, yes. just like, you know, you could play these on the piano. You could play these mm-hmm. with full orchestration if you wanted. I mean, just depends on how crazy you want to go with it. And,
yeah.
But I was thinking, like, in particular, like, if you overdrove his vocals a little bit, you know, added a little more reverb to them, you would have a garage rock revival record from, you know, mm-hmm. the past 10, 15 years. I mean, yeah. he really laid down the groundwork for a lot of different sounds, not just punk and not just bridging Velvet Underground to the Ramones. I think there's a lot to it. But I do think it's interesting just how untreated his voice is and mm-hmm. how sparse the record is. And it gives it this kind of like, it's kind of spooky vibe. You know?
It's really raw and naked.
And that's, I think that's probably my favorite aspect of it. Not quite grab me, but the sound of the record overall does.
So I ask all this mainly because I'm familiar with the Modern Lovers somewhat. I hadn't listened to any full lengths before a couple months ago. I was trying to listen to this album on a walk, and it wasn't quite the energy that I needed for like an energetic walk.
You had to sit down.
Yeah, it's not the type of it's not exercise music.
I need a girl that'll go to the museum with me. Oh, I need to sit down.
But my takeaway then was, maybe I'm not in the right mood for this. And so listening to it again this week, I found a lot more that I appreciate this time around. But overall, I guess I can revoke my music reviewing license, but I didn't really like it a lot. I know I'm in the minority. Like, this record is one of those music reviewer, like...
Yeah, well, it's a critic's darling.
It is, very much. And they always reminded me of stuff like... The way that they're talked about is the same way that I see bands like Big Star talked about. Mm-hmm. And, like, almost the mythos around them was more important than the music itself. Yeah. And that's not to say I think this is a bad record. There are four songs on here I genuinely like. Roadrunner, of course. I mean, that's
classic.
That's a classic. Hands down. Like, there's no way that cannot be considered a classic. And I also really enjoyed She Cracked and Modern World. I thought those were excellent.
Right.
And I thought, like, some of the other ones, like Someone I Care About and Old World, were pretty good, but they just didn't quite, like, do it so much for me. But you mentioned this song earlier. I really disliked the song Astral Plane. That was my
Before I go insane.
Yes.
It was my least favorite song
That's on awesome. The
record. Something about the melody, it just didn't work for it. Just
right.
I've heard this melody, not this particular melody, but this like style of melody before.
It sounds like the Doors.
Yeah, it's, I was going to say. Yeah.
That keyboard Doorsian, but super mopey.
Yes.
It's a kind of downer musically. Yeah.
I was actually going to say that song in particular to me is what I want the Doors to be.
I mean, yeah, I would definitely prefer the Doors to be this than some of the later Doors stuff. Which, right. Speaking of Doors, they often get kind of tagged as a proto-punk band. I don't agree with that, really. Because I feel like they borderline more on psychedelic than they do the punk aspects. Maybe it's just the simpleness of some of their songs, and that's why people throw that tag on there, but to me that's not the most accurate. But
the two bands that were mostly compared to the Doors were, of course, the Joy Division, because he sang in that same register.
Yeah.
And the Stranglers, of course, because they had a keyboard, you know. I mean, but you know, that's kind of simple, easy, you know.
Yeah, and I think you should punch anyone in the nose that that dares to say that the Doors are proto-punk.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we're not big Doors fans.
You know, I think they have some good songs, but yeah, the personality of the Doors, and then just how they'll go on for so long and a lot of this stuff.
I love the gaps between the songs. Yeah, I think that's the best part on any Doors record.
Absolutely.
I like a couple of the singles, but yeah, I listened to Morrison Hotel, I want to say, maybe 2 or 3 months ago, and I was like, what is this? Please turn it off.
Oh God, now we're going to have the ghost of Jim Morrison coming through hell.
You really do need drugs to appreciate the Doors, you know?
Share the modern world with me. Cause I'm in love with the USA now. I'm in love with the modern world now. Put down the cigarette and drop out of BU. Alright. That's right. Well, out in the afternoon, out in the airplane, we'll share a modern love under suburban rain. And be in love with the USA now, and be in love with the modern world now. Put down the cigarette and act like a true girl.
Now, again, to reinforce when you were introducing the Modern Lovers record, remember, it's just a collection of demos. It was never supposed to be a record.
Yeah.
That's kind of an interesting thing.
And I never listened to it this way. I listened to, like, the Berserkly, the Berserkly Years collection, you know, which has more songs that I like better than some of these.
Yeah, there's only 9 songs on the original record, and... Mm-hmm. It was never meant to be a record. It was demos. And Jonathan Richman has pretty much disowned it, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
I can tell you a little story. You know, I was involved, well, I still am involved in booking bands and on a small scale. And we book bands at a place in Greenville sometimes. And we had the chance to book Jonathan Richman. This was probably maybe 5 or 6 years ago. And we got his rider, and it was just, it was really kind of ridiculous. He's so paranoid about the sound, you know. And I'm the sound guy, you know.
Yeah.
He's like, no one can touch any sound. Jonathan must be able to run the sound on stage. No one can adjust any sound settings at any time during the show, you know. Huh. And it just goes on and on and on. You know, he wants it to be really quiet, you know. I get it, you know. And then it was like, you know, he doesn't have a cell phone and he doesn't have an email address.
You have to meet him on the astral plane.
Yeah, exactly.
Right?
Yeah, you have to call the payphone in the astral plane to get.
We can just say whatever we want about him here. He's right. Not going to hear.
Well, I mean, you know, I love Jonathan Richman. I love his music, but you know, it was just like. Well, we were looking at this rider. I was like, I don't want to deal with this. You know, this is not going to be good. You know, that's the kind of guy he is. You know, he's going to do his own thing. He disowned those to even call it a record. You know,
You're right. It's not a true record, and it is unfair to judge it as one. But I would probably enjoy. Mm-hmm. Hearing a full studio recording, you know, as far as like all the bells and whistles, just to see what would have come out. Right. Because I may be in the minority that prefers the more pop side of like the Velvet Underground. Like, I think I like Loaded more than most people compared to their earlier records. I'm not the biggest Velvet Underground fan. I respect and enjoy quite a bit of their music, but it's just as far as like all their albums all the way through, they're not always for me, but I do like the more pop side of Velvet Underground, and I'm curious to see if the Modern Lovers would have gone that direction. I guess it depends on who they would have wound up signing with, and
you were hitting earlier about the how these songs could be put in any style or any genre. I mean, it really is the songwriting here is. A version of, a modern version of the Great American Songbook, because I think the songs, the melodies, that these are songs that have a really good structure.
Mm-hmm.
It's translatable by lots of different artists. I'm surprised he's not covered more.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
He's definitely been ripped off a lot.
Right. So I think that pop side, you know, the notion that these are songs that you will want to sing along with, that, we cover Abominable Snowman because it was a great, fun song, you know, and the audience always
loved it
and sang along and danced along. Mm-hmm. But it's that pop side. It's that he wants you to like these songs.
Yeah. Now, I think one of the reasons you probably don't like him as much is because of his voice. It is kind of, it's not that great of a voice, you know?
not so much his voice. I think my biggest issue with the record is maybe the repetition.
Yeah.
I feel like all the songs go on a little longer than they need to. And I don't know if that's like, because they're demos, maybe there was more of a, like, we'll do something a little fancier here once we have time to like maybe write it. But maybe they were like, keeping the length with the intent of adding more to the song. I don't know. I would have been curious to see how a producer would have handled them, if they would have reined them back a little more, or if they would have just gone even crazier, or, you know.
There's even some lyrical repetition that's sort of... it's not like here's the... You know, it's not like it's a motif on the album, as if it had been intended by an album. Oh, I'm going to sing lots of songs about this. We'll keep seeing this character. It's almost... like glaziness, you know, like maybe kinda this lyrical like work song. Here, maybe this lyrical work here, you know, and it's basically saying the same thing in two different songs in the same way.
Right.
Yeah. It's hard to know what would even make the cut, you know, as far as like they could have written something later that they would have preferred to be on here. So it is weird to see this listed, you know, as an album when it's more just a compilation of various demo sessions. So
because you were talking about the mythos around it, you know, and there is definitely, you know, it's a Modern Lovers record, you know, it's spoken about in the same hushed tones as the Velvets, you know, and you know, it takes a while to get into it, and like with the Velvets, when you start to really get into it, you start to realize like every song you've ever been listening to has been, you know, these bands have been ripping off the Velvets. And, you know, it's like, oh, okay, oh, I get it now, you know?
Yeah.
You know,
so. Rosetta Stone.
Yeah,
absolutely. I want to just circle back around to something, Adrian, that you said about the Great American Songbook, and how that's kind of, that's almost like the mold that he writes in. And something that I thought about earlier when we talked about Roadrunner being pretty much just a complete rewrite of a Velvet Underground song.
Right, right.
It struck me like that's kind of a thing that people used to do. I mean, really just you took a melody that you knew and you wrote new lyrics to it. And so many songs are the version that you know is just a rewrite of, of an old song. You know, plenty of hymns are like that. You know, plenty of real early old time music and country music, and kind of the basis of country music is that.
Right. Wildwood Flower is based on a hymn and you know, same melody is This Land Is Your Land.
Right.
Yeah. Where you've got those things recurring. And I guess that gives it the timelessness because the reason that, it.
These melodies go back.
Yeah. Because those melodies are woven into our sort of musical memory. And and I think Jonathan touches on that, whether it's directly or it's just it's new fabric woven out of old threads.
I mean, when you, on your show, when you played the Velvet Underground, Sister Ray, I was like, oh, he improved it.
Your Honor, I rest my case.
It's a much better song than Sister Ray.
Well, that's debatable. Careful there.
Sure. Subjective. Entirely subjective art form.
You don't like an 18-minute long song with two chords?
Lightweight.
Some punk you are.
18 minutes is pushing it for the true punk, right?
Yeah. Well, you know, there's a reason. Short, loud, fast. That's the rule.
Right.
Don't bore us. Get to the chorus.
Yeah. So, unless anyone has any like really pressing thoughts on this record, we can give it a rating.
What about Jonathan Richman's filmography? he shows up and there's Something About Mary.
Right.
That's pretty genius, you gotta admit.
That's the beginning and end of his IMDb credits, right?
He's the Greek chorus.
Right, right.
Actually not. He shows up in a film which I also have kind of a personal connection to, and it's appropriately mundane for Jonathan Richman. He shows up in Kingpin, which I only know because over a Christmas break, I was at my mother-in-law's boyfriend's house in that in-law, like, interstitial period where you just like, well, I'm just going to sit here for several hours until the holidays are over.
Watching my watch.
And so I was watching TV, whatever channel it was on, and Kingpin, the Bill Murray comedy from 1996 is on, and Jonathan Richman shows up in a band playing in a bar.
I gotta watch Kingpin. Thanks a lot.
It's the only reason to watch it. I mean, but
now you guys,
I'm watching
him
play, and I'm like, why do I recognize his voice? So I just like look it up. I'm like, who's the band in Kingpin?
So it's like Jonathan Richman himself.
Of all people, Jonathan Richman. Like, why not a ska band? I mean, that was typical of
yeah, the
96.
Now, you guys have seen Repo Man, right?
I actually have not.
No.
Oh, God.
I know.
You've got to see Repo Man. Go directly to jail. Go see Repo Man. You guys will love it. But in that, there's a scene where they play Pablo Picasso, and it's not his version. It's a cover by another band, but it sounds exactly like it. And
like the Modern Lovers version.
Yeah, it's beautiful. And that movie is Alex Cox. He did Sid and Nancy and Walker and all kinds of crazy movies.
Yeah.
Yeah, you need to see that one, though.
Yeah, that's that is one that I should watch for sure. It's
yes.
I understand its importance too. There's not too many punk films in general, so like I should probably see all the big ones.
My parents nearly got divorced over it. My mother thought it was the best thing she'd ever saw, and my dad was like, "This is paradigmatic BS. I know what they were trying to do. I just don't think they did it very well." And for decades they would argue about Repo Man. It was if you've got the interstitial holiday doldrums, that's what you would do to spark a conversation with me and my parents about Repo Man.
Well, let's go ahead and give this one a rating so we can get into our EP. Normally we use a scale of 1 to 5, and you can use the quarter points between as your rating.
Lowest goes first.
All right, I guess that'll be me. I'm going to give it a 3.0 out of 5. I'm dead in the middle. I think there are 4 excellent songs that I really enjoy. Some of the others are okay, and I don't like a couple. I know that it has the reputation of being like one of the greatest albums of all time, or you know, their music in general is considered extremely highly rated. Like on the Rate Your Music page, it has a 3.91 out of 5, which if you know your Rate Your Music scores, that's very, very good. Anything close to 4 or over is essentially classic standard. So I'm in the minority on this record, but Dylan, what did you think of this one?
I would say I'm probably about a 4.25. I kind of like the mythos enough and the sound of the record that the parts that don't necessarily excite me maintain my interest, because there's just this kind of mystique to it. And I genuinely love some of these songs. And I think that Jonathan Richman is a really interesting voice in a rock band, especially because he's got a limited range and he just makes it work. And he lives kind of in the Lou Reed shadow, but I don't know. I think he stands on his own, and he's definitely not as sleazy. And at least here on The Modern Lovers, his lyrics are maybe not as, you know, goofy as probably what Lou Reed was doing around this time. So I think there's a lot here to revisit. And, and that's kind of where, you know, as far as I place things in the 4 and up range, how much do I want to come back to it? What about you?
Let's have Steve go first.
I would say probably about a 4.25, mainly because it's the record. I love the songs. I was raised in Massachusetts in that area. I kind of get a little bit more maybe than the average person would. He meant a lot to my songwriting. Realizing you can be direct and you don't have to use flowery language and everything, you know, because I'm also a big Elvis Costello fan, and he never says anything the way it's supposed to be said, you know, which is cool about him, you know, but it's good to have that kind of just direct, this is how I'm feeling, I'm telling you what's going on. And, you know, I do like the songs, and his themes are a lot more sophisticated than they appear to be, you know, the one foot in the old world, the one foot in the new world. You know, he likes the old world. He still loves his parents. How many songs do you have that have a chorus that say, "I love the USA"? You know, I mean, that's punk AF, you know?
Yeah.
That's my rating. What do you think, Adrian?
Well, mine is a 3.91. I think the math got it correct by settling on that, because it is not a carefully crafted collection. I think there's some repetitions. I think they're recordings that are better. I think an album that had been deliberately selected would have, you know, I think there's a 5 out there in their recordings that, and Berserkly has them, but I don't think this is a 5 collection. I think that, you know, for the reasons we've discussed, there's some repetitiveness there, you know, it's not the 9 strongest songs.
Right.
And they're not even 9 of the most they don't flow together in any particularly creative or interesting way. So, you know, it loses its points for as an album, because I don't think because it's an album in name, but not an album in structure.
Right.
Well, awesome.
It's kind of like Nebraska by Springsteen. You know, it was really just a collection of demos, but you kind of give it a story.
Right,
And you kind of force it to mesh together, and there are weak moments.
Yeah.
All right. Well, we will move into our EP, and on the regular music charts, it is number 3 on the EP charts overall, and it is Radio Birdman with their EP Burn My Eye. 1, 2, 3, 4. See the plan coming down. Radio Birdman formed in 1974, and for some reason I made a mistake and did not actually put the year that this, put the month that this came out, but I guess it doesn't really matter.
This was released late 76.
Yeah,
late 76. October, I think.
They're from Sydney, Australia. This was released on Trafalgar Records.
Trafalgar?
Yes. Yeah. I don't know why I always get stuck on that. who also released records by the Fleshtones and the Helicopters. So that's kind of the big stuff they put out. The personnel on this record is Rob Younger on vocals, Dennis Tech on guitars, Chris Masuk on guitars and piano, Warwick Gilbert on bass, and Ron Keeley on drums. And the record was produced by Charles Fisher and John Sayers. And Charles Fisher also produced quite a few other records. Most notably, Air Supply, The Divinyls, Savage Garden, Ace of Base.
So he definitely had a type, didn't he?
Yeah.
Deep Blue Something and Olivia Newton-John.
So, hey.
Wow.
You always see them traveling in a pack.
Yes.
So, not as much information as far as the background on this, other than Radio Birdman were one of the first Australian punk bands, along with the Saints.
Right.
And when I listened to the Saints, we talked about them previously. We listened to one of their albums, and I was like, man, I really did not give Australian punk like its due, because listening to this EP as well, I was surprised at how good Radio Birdman were. Dylan, you texted me last night, and you said, I got to find out what the heck a Radio Birdman is tomorrow. and I looked it up, and their name was actually from a misheard Stooges lyric.
Right.
The actual line was Radio Burnin'.
Right. In 1969, I think. Mm.
The song.
Yeah.
Not the year.
Right. Yeah.
But maybe both.
Mm-hmm. Well, the song was written in the year, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And speaking of the Stooges, the Radio Birdman do cover TVI on their first full length album, so that kind of gives you an idea of what style of music we're dealing with here. As the guests, what did you two think of this record?
Well, the first person I ever knew who had a Radio Birdman record was Adrian.
Yes, I have the album.
Yeah, she has the first album. What's it called? I can't remember. Something
Radio.
Yeah, anyway, the first album.
I listened to it yesterday. I used to be able to remember.
The story is that Seymour Stein went over to Australia to sign the Saints to Sire. But somehow he saw a Radio Birdman, and he signed them as well. and they re-released the first record was already out, the LP, but they re-released it in the U.S. and they changed it some. But,
yeah, Radios Appear is the name of the film.
Radios Appear. Oh, there we go. That's it. Yeah, right. And I remember going to visit Adrian, you know, back in the day, and I was like, "What is this? This looks interesting."
Yeah, I bought it on the strength of the Hawaii 50, you know, the Book of Dana. Was it Aloha Steve?
Yeah, and Aloha Steve. Now, were they playing that on Davidson Radio?
They may have been playing that. You know, my early punk listening, alternative listening, was the overnight NPR station. Was jazz all day, classical mm-hmm. all day, and at night they'd play local stuff and mm-hmm. And punk.
Is
and
it WDAV?
Yes, WDAV. Yes,
we grew up
outside of Statesville in Iredell County.
Adrian lived in Statesville.
Oh, okay, yeah. So you definitely. Mm-hmm. I don't know if they were still doing that overnight show.
They weren't. It was just classical music.
Yeah, it was really classical.
So this would have been late 70s, early 80s. Mm-hmm. And yeah, so I was like, hey, I've got to go get that.
Mm-hmm. And it was rocking.
It was.
Now, you guys know that the main guy in Radio Birdman, Dennis Tech, he's actually from Michigan.
Okay. I did not see that. No.
This is where the connection comes because, you know, they're so into the Stooges. When they got a place to play, they got a club and they called it the Fun House and in Sydney. And, you know, obviously they were influenced big time by the Stooges and the MC5 and other bands.
Yeah, they really play well.
Yes.
I mean, you know, this isn't like, mm-hmm. oh, what's this? It's a guitar. What are those two chords?
It's not punk. That Jonathan Richman song. It's blazing. If you go to YouTube and listen to that EP, the next thing that pops up is a live performance of them around the same time at some hotel in Australia, and they are just blistering. I mean, they are killing it. It's like, wow, you know, it's really, they're on it. They can play. They're not some amateurs, you know.
Dylan, yeah, what do you think?
Going off of that note, I wanted to point out the guitar work and the drumming especially are just mm-hmm. they're excellent. I mean, Ron Keeley is like a machine.
Yeah.
So many of those snare fills are just faster than anything punk did for a long time.
Mm-hmm. Well, because they can play. They can play really well.
Right,
It's not just
they hadn't. They obviously just hadn't picked up their instruments. They'd been playing, you know.
Yeah. I mean, the solos on these songs are amazing. Like, I don't know who's doing the solo work on there, but they're killing it, especially on the first two tracks, Smith & Wesson Blues and Snake. Mm-hmm. And then there's that really cool surfy like guitar part in I-94. Yeah.
Yeah. That song to me sounded like the Wipers 4 years early. Like it's exactly the same thread of early rock and roll and surf rock into like acid rock even. Like some of these songs almost reminded me of like Golden Earring. Like
similar, that's a good catch. Like, yeah,
tonality and sense of timing.
Another band that they got a lot of influences from was the dreaded Blue Oyster Cult.
But yeah, don't have that proggy.
Yeah, but they definitely have a little bit of that flavor to them. You know, that
hard rock.
Yeah, hard rock with some real soloing and you know.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, because the solo stuff is not really a punk tradition, you know, especially at this point.
Yeah,
but they even have some. I even hear a little bit of like some Rolling Stones, Richard mm-hmm. Hill, even like some mm-hmm. sort of janglier guitar moments. Like, I mean, I was very surprised at how much I enjoyed this EP. One thing we've run into quite a bit doing the show around the 70s and 80s, you'll come across a lot of bands that are almost described as like also ran type punk bands.
Yeah.
Where it's like they were around, but they didn't have the songs or the, show
right.
or the following, but they're considered important due to being there at the right time. Mm-hmm. And I was curious if this was going to be an example of one of those bands. And much like with the Saints, No, they were really good in their own right.
Right. And, you know, you've got that whole thing with Australia. It's like, this is, you know, the place where the animals all look different, you know, because they, it's just, it's not, things grow up differently in Australia. Mm-hmm. And it seems like they come from that really rough and tumble, you know, former penal colony sort of thing, where if you go out and you play in a rock band and you go to these clubs,
you
know,
it's the Detroit of countries.
Yeah, you know,
it makes sense. Yeah. Everybody went from Detroit to,
I mean, you got to be, you got to be ready to fight. You know, you got to bring the punters the rock. And you know, this is how AC/DC came up. It's how Midnight Oil came up. You know, the Saints. Australia's a tough place to play. You know, you've got to have the goods, and you could tell that these guys could get on a stage and face anybody down and be like, you know, check this out, you know.
I was reading about you. You said they created their own place called the Funhouse, and I really liked they had like the DIY ethic of, well, we couldn't find anybody to like let us play on stage, so let's just rent a garage and like put our own shows on. So
yeah, our band did that as well.
Yeah, we definitely were finding any place that would let us put in some instruments and let us play.
Drive through coffee shop. Can we have hardcore shows? Yeah,
exactly. I promise you'll do it once.
I really enjoyed Rob Younger's vocal style. He has like a lower voice. It's a little bit more gravelly, a little more growly. The guitar work is fantastic. Dylan, you pointed out the drumming was great. Like, I highly enjoyed this EP. I thought these songs were great. And again, I was looking at like what the overall sound of rock music in 76 was. Mm-hmm. And it's a lot of progressive rock, like AOR, you know.
Yeah, the Eagles.
Yeah, Boston put out their self-titled.
Oh, yeah.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Queen. A lot of Queen.
A lot of Queen.
And yeah, and hard rock is the other thing going on. So I was thinking about how this was punk, and it's not so much punk in the sense.
Right. It's like just dirty metal.
Yeah, compared to like the mainstream rock that was going on, which was way bigger sounding, way more self-indulgent. And I like that these songs really get to the point. Like, they're short, they're fast, they're, I would have loved to have seen them like in their heyday. Like, that would, I bet that would have been crazy to see.
Yeah, you got to look at that footage on YouTube. It's really impressive.
I have to pull it up.
Yep. It reminds me, I don't know if you guys, one of my favorite records from this year is an Australian band called Amyl and the Sniffers. Have you heard them?
From the, not 1976, but
this year.
2019.
From
I've seen their that album on the Rate Your Music charts for 2019. Yeah.
You guys need to check it out. It is it's cut from the same cloth. Mm. They're young, so they pick, you know, they do AC/DC, there's a little Damned in there, there's some Radio Birdman, they just kind of pick and choose whatever the hell they want. And they have this great female singer. She's awesome. The band is, I mean, they got the riffs. And if you ever see the footage of them, they're just devastating on stage. It's a great record. It really is. You should check it out. And it I can see the line from bands like Radio Birdman and AC/DC. And there's a lot more Australian bands that I don't know about, the Saints and, you know, others, to this sort of thing, Amel and the Sniffers. There's a review on our website about it, and it's just a great record. And it's kind of in the same.
Right. Yeah. Australia's still coming across with that attitude, or people are coming out of Australia with that.
Yeah,
you know, we're going to be incredibly proficient.
We're going to rock.
We're going to put on a great show.
Yeah,
we're going to get to the point.
I definitely felt a little bit more rawness to like the Australian punk records from this time that I listened to, compared to like UK punk around the time, because we've said it before, like UK punk, they almost like immediately jettisoned the punk sound and move into post-punk within the first year of it blowing up. So I like that the edge that the Saints and this Radio Birdman record have compared to, because even in the US, like it wasn't until really hardcore took off in the States that you started to see a lot of like edge to the punk rock here. I mean, you had the Germs and stuff, which are proto hardcore, but X was like a really melodic band. So
The Ramones were the first wave. They were not part of the hardcore wave, you know?
Right.
They were older.
Yeah. They were in that valley between the Ramones
and Black Flag.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So yeah, I need to dive deeper into Australian punk and see what I'm missing there.
Yeah, I think maybe everybody could benefit from that.
Yeah,
Radio Birdman is good stuff though.
Yeah, I would really like to hear more of their stuff. Radio Birdman is actually one of those bands that I want to say like most of their music isn't on Spotify, which is forces you to find it elsewhere.
Right,
and that can always be a little conducive to getting into an artist, because you listen to music in the car so much and things like that, usually where I get to know a new band. I mean, you know, there's the Essential album,
right,
which I guess is the greatest hits, but I don't know, there's quite a bit on there actually. But yeah, there's just a band that slipped by me for a really long time until this episode. I think I had an entirely different impression of them before listening to this EP. So I'm excited to listen to more. You mentioned Dr. Feelgood earlier. That's I feel this definitely has more of a kinship to that pub rock sound than maybe.
Yeah, we were remarking punk rock. The same thing. It's specifically Feelgood. You know, it's got that high energy. Mm-hmm.
It's Australian pub rock, which is much harder than British.
Right. It's got that Australian attitude.
Right.
It's got like a dingo. Bluesy structure to it.
Yeah.
You know, a little more of a snarl.
Mm. Bar rock, as it would be in the States. And
Right. Yeah, those Australians are just badasses.
Well, unless anyone has any other pressing thoughts on this EP, we could give it a rating.
Sure.
I'll go first. I am going to give this a 4.25. I very much enjoyed it. And actually looking at all the songs, because when I write my notes out for when we listen to these albums, I rate each song individually. And I gave every single song a 4.25. Except for the last one, I gave a 4.5. So, and I'm almost curious if I would even rate some of these a little higher on a second or a third or fourth listen.
Right.
I'd listen to it twice for sure to do the show. But I was very happy to find this and listen to this. And I went and listened to the first half of their full length after listening to this EP. So yeah, I've really enjoyed it. Dylan, what do you think?
I'm in the same place, 4.25. I think that maybe the songwriting here isn't as strong as our album, most of the great songs on that album. but the musicianship here just takes things to such a high level. And the vocals are really strong. And honestly, I think Rob is a better vocalist than maybe Iggy Pop, which is kind of...
Ooh. Mm. Interesting.
Mm.
Strong words, young man.
Iggy was
more willing to
go out on a limb. And so he maybe has some higher highs.
Oh, he had highs, that's for sure.
Right.
Who can believe that the picture of Bowie and Lou and Iggy, who would have bet money that the only one alive would be Iggy now? I mean, come on.
Wow. Yeah. And all right. He seems to be doing great, too.
Yes, yes.
I know.
He's immortal.
He is.
Not just musically. I mean, I think.
He must have made a deal with somebody. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, he pretty much looks the same as he has since like 77.
Yeah. When you look like a piece of jerky,
you're
in your 20s, on, you know, there's nothing will change. Mm-hmm.
Well preserved.
Yeah. I think he probably just had less success. So he kind of had to slow down in terms of his rock star antics.
It's the golf. See, I think it's probably the golf the that's golf. Preserving.
He's quite the tough one. So what's your rating?
I think I'm going to go for the Price is Right model and go for a 4.26 doing the one up. Because I agree that, you know, that I think that on the album later on that the songs themselves get stronger, but that, you know, the ingredients are here, that the high level of musicianship, the enthusiasm, those connections to rocking hard. I know that sounds like a cliche, but I mean here you see it. This is the truth behind the cliche, because that's in fact what they're doing.
So I guess I'll give it the low score.
Ooh.
I'm going for the 3.5.
It's the East German judge.
Yeah. I mean, I like the idea of Radio Birdman more than I actually like the songs.
Mm-hmm. He's just envious because I have the album.
Oh, yeah, I know. I really am. That's always burned me up. But, you know, I like Radio Birdman. I wouldn't say that I would reach for this EP and listen to it over and over, because they don't have much going on melodically. They can play and they can rock, though, and I like that. And some of the later stuff is better, for sure. But, you know, it's like the MC5. I love the MC5. But a lot of their stuff is kind of, you know, the same.
I kind of only listen to Kick Out of the Jams.
Yeah.
I mean, I mean, I know the other stuff's good, too, but that's really the one I go to.
Right. Yeah. That's the MC5. Their records are just, they couldn't pull off in the studio what they did live. Didn't translate.
So as far as Radio Birdman's concerned, I'd probably be listening to Amel and the Sniffers.
but how about this? How about we combine the two artists for today and then we have Radio Birdman perform that from the songbook
of Jonathan Richman.
Yeah. That would be incredible.
Cool.
You get the melody, but with the musicianship and the enthusiasm.
I'd like to hear Radio Birdman doing Pablo Picasso. That would be pretty awesome.
Yeah, specifically. That would be outstanding.
I am curious if they ever did anything like that. I mean, they're from the same era, so you'd think there'd be a good chance, but I don't know. Well, tell everyone where we can follow Singles Going Steady, or we can buy records you guys put out. You know, tell everybody.
Well, you can find all of that stuff at our headquarters online, which is zubrecords.com.
Z-U-B.
Records.com. There's links to the Singles Going Steady podcast, which we've got that in all the podcatcher places if you prefer to go there. But we've got some great links for all the podcasts. We've recorded over 60 already, and we're getting ready to do our next batch soon. So we release two every 2 weeks, so you can keep up.
And we have a blog called The Zub Alert, where we do a lot of reviews. We'll be reviewing the Stiff Little Finger show tonight.
Hell yeah. And,
there's a lot of cool album reviews and live reviews. I just saw Red Cross. I'll be writing about them soon. That was amazing. And, we have a record release coming out in the next couple of months.
Yeah, no dates to be announced, but that's we've got a store there. Mm-hmm. So if and when you'll be able to, we've got a few stickers and things like that now. But as
t-shirts.
Far as and a handful of our first batch of t-shirts are going to be collector's items. So that's us.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. And I'll make sure to include links to all that in the show notes as well. Thank you. And you can follow us on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. We're at PunkLottoPod. We have an email address. It's PunkLottoPod@gmail.com. And our website is PunkLottoPod.simplecast.fm. Next week, I don't know what we're talking about because we're recording these way in advance and out of order. So it'll be a mystery. we'll be going down to Fest next week, which it's funny to say that because by the time this episode goes up, we'll have already posted our Fest episode. So anyway, we'll be
time traveling
extravaganza. And we'll be seeing and we'll be seeing Stiff Little Fingers as well.
Yay!
They're performing Fest. So if I wasn't going to Fest, I would be there right now seeing Stiff Little Fingers tonight. So, are the Avengers playing the show as well?
Yes.
Yeah, they're going to be at Fest as well. So I'll get to see them as well. But yeah, thanks a lot for doing the show. This was a lot of fun.
Our pleasure. I hope things go well for you and,
have fun at the shows.
Let's keep talking about punk rock.
God, that's terrible. It's worse than Daryl's bloody core on Glay.